You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You're listening to the Great Plains Archaeology Podcast. Join me as we uncover the rich histories of North America's Great Plains, exploring the latest archaeological discoveries and past cultures that shaped this storied region. Welcome to the podcast. Welcome to the Great Plains Archaeology Podcast, episode 29. I am your host, Professor Carlton Shield Chief Gover, where we uncover the rich and fascinating histories of North America's Great Plains. Today, I am pretty excited, really excited. Our guest today is Rob Bozell, who is the former Nebraska State Archaeologist and the recipient of the William Duncan Strong Memorial Award. Rob, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. How are you doing this afternoon?
I'm great, and I'm honored. Thanks for having me on, Carlton. I mean it.
Yeah, seriously. Of course. I've known you now for about a decade, I think.
Yeah, probably. I think we met when you first, Roger Echohawk introduced us virtually, and I think it was when you were just starting graduate school. Probably
early on. Yeah. At Wyoming, and we met in person at a Plains conference in Bismarck, I think, and got a chat.
Yeah. Me and you and Bob Horde sat there.
That's right.
And you walked away and we thought, this kid's never going to make it. But look at you now. Look at you now. Just kidding.
No, you guys have been great. I've been very fortunate to know some really great state archaeologists. So you've had a pretty long career in archaeology. Did you start as the highway archaeologist at Nebraska, or was there a time before that where you were doing something else?
I'm native Nebraskan. And went to school at UNL. I graduated in the late 70s. I think I worked at the Midwest Archaeological Center for less than a year in the early 80s. And then I guess my first real permanent job was with the State Historical Society as a highway archaeologist. And I have Steve Holland to thank for that. Steve was in that position. He wanted to do something else and was going to be the director of the Dawson County Historical Society, which is where he's from, central Nebraska, and recommended to the then director, Marvin Kivett, that I get that job. And so I have Steve to thank for it, and I really appreciate it. So yeah, started a highway archaeologist and really stayed at the Historical Society until I retired a couple, 3 years ago. The only time I left was I spent 3 years at Augustana College at the archaeology lab up there in Sioux Falls, where Casey works. But other than that, it was spent my entire career at the State Historical Society.
Gotcha. And so after being the highway archaeologist, then you became the program manager for like the whole department, and then you were the state archaeologist after that?
There were several positions. You know, we didn't really have a state archaeologist until 2005 because we didn't have a law. So we didn't have a formal one. But whoever was the head of the archaeology division was kind of the de facto state archaeologist. And that was me for most of my career. It was Gail Carlson for a while, off and on. Gail and I traded a couple times. But yeah, it was sort of that position, either formally state archaeologist after 2005 or six, and then kind of de facto as department head since 88, I think, is when I took over.
Gotcha. And like starting in the late 80s is running that program and into the 90s, you know, what was the climate around archaeology like during that time period?
Well, going back a little further, the late 70s and 80s was a really kind of heady time for archaeology, because there was a lot of big CRM projects and a lot of opportunities. In Nebraska, at UNL, we had lots of contracts with the Corps of Engineers, big reservoir salvage things, and the Bureau of Reclamation, reservoirs, canals, all over Nebraska, Kansas, South Dakota. So that was a really good environment, that you know, both in academic departments, KU, Nebraska, a lot of Iowa. There was a lot of students, there was a lot of jobs, there was a lot of opportunities for students to go into career track jobs. And so that was what I sort of grew out of, and I really appreciate having all of those opportunities. At the Historical Society, when I landed my first permanent job, it was equally kind of lucrative, because the Historical Society had then, and had since 1959, and still does today, a cooperative agreement with our Department of Transportation to do much of the highway archaeology statewide, which is great, because it always employed up to three or four people, up to 10 people, students. And it's been a great program, and it's been a great springboard for, you know, myself and a lot of other people to, you know, stay and actively involved in field archaeology. So, yeah, it's CRM has been very good to me. It really has. Yeah.
Yeah, I bet. So even kind of before that, what got you engaged with archaeology, being homegrown Nebraskan? What was that kind of impetus for having to go to UNL to get a undergraduate and master's degree?
I think a lot of it was my parents. You know, neither one of them are archaeologists, but they both really liked history. And when I was a kid, they were always dragging me around to museums. I remember going to Williamsburg when I was a kid. My mom took me to Fort Atkinson, north of Omaha, when they were working there in the early 60s. I have a, you know, a real distinct memory of that. And they also, again, having both of them have this interest in history, there was just a lot of kind of history books around the house, you know, and it wasn't just archaeology, but it was, you know, World War II stuff and Revolutionary War, Civil War stuff. Plus, I was a terrible student, Carlton. I was terrible. I couldn't do math. I hated math. The teachers used to tell my parents, I think Robbie has a learning disability. But I always really liked history and I liked maps. And I remember when I was probably a junior, sophomore in college, I asked my dad, what should I major in? And he said, what do you want to get up and be excited about doing every morning for the next 50 years? And I thought, well, I always kind of like this history stuff, and that's kind of how I did it. And I met a couple professors at UNL, Peter Bleed and Carl Falk in particular. And they, both those guys, really influenced me heavily and got me jobs doing this stuff for the Corps of Engineers and the Bureau. And I just never looked back. I credit my parents. And I think that people, and you know this, sometimes people come into your life, educators or somehow somebody influences you that just kind of changes your life. And I think Carl and Peter were sort of those people for me where I thought, I want to be like these guys, you know, I want to do what these guys do. And so I was just really fortunate to be able to be in the right place at the right time, to have the right educators that you know, maintain my interest in this stuff and also the opportunities. Yeah.
That's excellent. So what were some of the most memorable projects you got to work on in the 80s?
The first year I was there, John Ludvigson and I, who is my partner, John just passed away this last year. He was the other highway archaeologist after Steve left. And we excavated big earth lodge floor at the Patterson site, which was my first experience to a major excavation. You know, I'd done lots of testing and survey, but that was something else. I mean, it was a great big house, very complicated, stuff all over the floor, lots of features. And John had been working in field archaeology since he was in high school. He worked at the Smithsonian. I worked on River Basin surveys in the early, you know, mid-60s up in high school. And just to learn about how to excavate, how to map, how to record features, how to do, you know, how to collect soil samples, that was really exciting for me. That first made, you know, I've done dug a lot of houses since then, but that first one, I was fortunate that it was a really big, really complicated house to dig and probably made some mistakes, but that's how you learn. So that was fun. The other one that was really interesting is the McIntosh site, another Central Plains Jurisdiction site that was out in the middle of the Sandhills on a Sandhills Lake, completely unanticipated. You know, the Sandhills are a really interesting area, a lot of archaeology, but it seems like it's going to be lots of transitory stuff, hunting camps. This was a real kind of honest to God Central Plains village out in the middle of right on a lake shore, you know, way out in the middle of nowhere. They're growing corn and, you know, building some kind of houses and doing everything that you would get in eastern Nebraska or eastern Kansas or, you know, southern Nebraska, north central Kansas, but out in the middle of nowhere. Really interesting, still really interesting, you know, what that's all about, whether it's climate related or, you know, why people are moving up into the Sandhills. It's one of the more interesting sites in Nebraska, and I was felt fortunate to work on it. And it was another one of those deals. It was a county road. The county was using dirt from the site for fill material, and we got a report of artifacts and went up there and the county and the Nebraska DOT paid for the excavations. And, you know, it was, yeah, a lot of fun. I think, that, and then the third thing, I'll quit blathering, is working with Gail Carlson at Fort Atkinson. He did a lot of work there. And working at Fort Atkinson, I think, is one of the premier historic and archaeological sites in Nebraska. It's the 1820, 1827 first military post west of the Missouri. And that was my first real exposure to kind of, Euro-American archaeology, forts, fur trading posts, that kind of stuff, which is different. I mean, it's different subject matter. You're still digging holes in the ground, but it's, you've got archival records, you've got, different kinds of information that you can bring to bear other than just what's in the ground. So.
That's awesome. I forgot that you excavated the McIntosh site.
Yeah, you and John did. Yeah, yeah.
That's a lot of fun. Well, not to like totally turn everything on its head. So you're in working for this office into the 90s. And of course, we have NAGPRA drop in 1990. How did that change the Native American Graves Protection Act? How did that change the climate of the office, but also increase the workload for what you guys were doing?
Well, it actually started for us a year or so before then, because there was initiative by local tribes, Winnebago, Omaha, Ponca, to pass a Nebraska burial law. And so that's when we first got into it. And I'll tell you, people say, well, how did it affect the relationship between indigenous people and archaeology museums? Before that, was it a good relationship, a bad relationship? Neither one. There was no relationship. There really just, at least in my world, there really wasn't any interaction between tribes and archaeologists. Very little. And so initially, there was acrimony. And I remember being really personally conflicted about it. I felt, in terms of repatriation of remains and sacred objects, and it was very difficult because I felt personally one way and kind of professionally another way. And I sort of was on the other side of, whether we should repatriate. And there was a law passed. I do remember, this is kind of an anecdote which you'll like, that the Nebraska tribes were having some difficulty getting a law passed. And there was lots of negotiations and they weren't going well for the tribes. Nebraska's a pretty conservative state. And I was in a meeting one time at the Capitol, sitting next to Jim Hansen, who was our director at the time. And we were around a table, some Native folks, some archaeology folks, and in walks this kind of skinny little bespeckled guy with braids. And Hansen leans over to me and says, "We're going to lose." And I said, "Who's this guy?" He said, "His name's Walter Echohawk, and we're going to lose." And that's when Walter got involved. And he got involved because it was the Native American Rights Fund in Boulder at the time. But he was Pawnee. And most of the remains that we had at the State Historical Society were Pawnee or ancestral Pawnee. The vast majority were. So there was a Nebraska law passed. Walter and a bunch of other people did a really commendable job of getting a law passed. And then NAGPRA came the next year. A lot of people will say NAGPRA was modeled after Nebraska. I think in part, I wasn't involved in developing NAGPRA on a national level. There's certainly some similarities, but there's a lot of differences. For one thing, the Nebraska law deals with all human remains, not just indigenous. And it's so if you've got remains on federal land that are found or tribal land, NAGPRA applies. But the Nebraska law applies to the rest of the state. Doesn't matter what land, whether it's state land, private land, which is great. It's got a mechanism. That's the one thing that we all agreed on was, we need some kind of mechanism to deal with what happens when remains are found inadvertently, because it happens all the time, as you know. It happens from construction sites, farming, erosion. Grandpa dies and there's literally a skeleton in the attic because he was a doctor or a dentist or something. You'd be surprised how many of those cases we dealt with. So it was initially acrimony, but I got to tell you, and I mean this in all sincerity, that I think that NAGPRA and the state laws, which are in many laws. And the other thing is the formation of the ZIPOs. And in 2010, some of the early 2000s, when Section 106 rules were redone to include tribal consultation, all of the NAGPRA and the Section 106 revisions that form FIPPOs are, you know, with some bumps, are really a positive thing for archaeology. I mean, they really are. It's a work in progress, probably always will be, but it's, I don't think you'd find too many archaeologists to say, oh, that's a bad idea and this has not been good. I think it's been, I mean, there are, but I think it's been good. I have found it to be, you know, to when you get native perspective on things, it creates for a richer past. You know, it really does. There's different ways of knowing about the past. So overall, it, you know, when I look back now, you know, things like NAGPRA were long overdue and we're in a better place. Still a work in progress, but we're in a better place.
Absolutely. That's a great point for us to wrap up this first segment. We'll be right back here on episode 29 of the Great Plains Archaeology Podcast with Rob Bozell. Stay tuned. And we're back with episode 29 here with Rob Bozell, the former state archaeologist from Nebraska. And so, Rob, being in that position, working for the state, and as the state archaeologist for almost, what, 2-3 decades?
Yeah.
Officially, as the official state archaeologist for about 15, 17. You know, from your perspective, what, you know, how is archaeology doing and where it's going, and how has it changed as a discipline since your time being a professional archaeologist?
Well, it's a good question. I think that a couple of things that I have always kind of been concerned about, and one is, who is our audience? Who's our audience and who should be our audience? You hear a lot of people, and we joke around about, you know, academic archaeology versus CRM, which I don't think there's a lot of difference. But I've always felt, and people have disagreed with me, that I don't have any specific numbers, but I think that the vast majority of archaeology, whether it be at the, you know, academic level or the cultural resource management level or whatever, is taxpayer funded. It's taxpayer funded. It's public. And I've always felt we have an obligation to the public, which we haven't always done a great job of that. And I think we've gotten better at it. But, I think there's a lot of people out there that are not archaeologists that really have a real interest. You know, a lot of people need to have something in their life that they're really interested in, or multiple things. And that may be art or music or sports or hiking or, you know, spending time with their family or, you know, there's all kinds of stuff. But there's a lot of people that really dig history and archaeology. You know, like I was telling you about how I got into this stuff, because my parents liked it. Neither one of them are historians or archaeologists. So I'd like to think that we're doing a better job, but we need to continue to do a better job of making archaeology more accessible to the public, whether it's through, you know, exhibits and hands-on, you know, engagement, public excavations, videos, lectures. And right now we're working on a book, which I know you're looking at because you've been asked to review it, that's kind of for the general public, you know, that you cut out a lot of jargon, cut out, you know, all of the research, the nitty-gritty research, the science, the teaching, all that says is absolutely necessary. But it can't stop there. I think that we have a commitment to the public to try to give things to people that are accessible. And that's kind of why we're working on this book. And, we'll see how it turns out. It's going to have a lot of pictures, which is good. So that's one thing that I think state archaeology offices, are doing, they've done, they will continue to do. You know, I mean, you know, back in the old days, and I'm talking about way before my time or your time, it was pretty much archaeologists doing archaeology for other archaeologists. You know, it wasn't, you know, I mean, yeah, there was museum exhibits, but, you know, there wasn't a whole lot of, you know, concern about the public. Oh, you know, who cares about those people? You know, I want to impress my colleagues. And we've gotten beyond that. And I think that's a good thing. As I mentioned in the fish segment, I think that, you know, having descendant populations involved in archaeology is a really good thing too. And whether that's indigenous or African American or Asian American or whatever, you know, whatever, is another really good thing, because it adds a dimension that archaeologists, which were largely Caucasian until, you know, the last few decades. You know, I mean, you can spend a lot of time measuring arrowheads and, you know, measuring pots and going to conferences and talk about your measurements of your arrowheads and your pots and comparing with people's other measurements. And, you know, but it's like for the public, they're like, well, who cares? You know, I mean, tell me something interesting. Tell me how these people lived. So, they're both good, but that's something I've seen, you know, and as a real positive shift. And also, I don't want to get political, but we're in a time right now where, you know, heavy-handed government regulation is not popular, you know, and I think that, you know, we need to do a better job, and we are doing it, of making ourselves interesting and popular and vital to people. Anyway, not to blather on about that, but that's something that I, you know, have felt pretty strongly about in terms of, you know, what archaeology ought to be. It ought to be academic, but it also ought to be something that people with an interest in it can have access to it, you know. So.
Absolutely. No, it's not blathering at all. And as state archaeologists, weren't you guys running, and still are, it's not a field school, but you guys like run volunteer opportunities for the public to join.
We do. Nebraska, we don't do it nearly as well as other states. You know, I didn't do a very good job. Dave's probably going to pick up on that and do better than I did. You know, Kansas has done a great job, you know, of doing that with the KAA and all that. They've been doing it for decades. And there are other states too. Yeah. You know, it's easy for me to say, yeah, this is all this great stuff, although I hadn't done a lot of it. You know, I wish I had done more, you know, but that takes money and stuff like that. But no, I think there's some great models. Kansas is one, you know, and there are probably many other states where you get the people involved, you know. That's good. It's good. It's a lot of work.
Yeah, and you've also been good at being able to give public presentations. So I know there's like a lot of your presentations on YouTube, which was funny because like my uncle, he's retired and spends a lot of his time, you know, just kind of like surfing the internet, and he likes Pawnee history. And I had a text from him one day. He's like, do you know Rob Bozell? And I was like, yeah, of course I know Rob Bozell. And he like sent one of your videos. I'm like, yes, you can watch that. It's a good one.
Who's your uncle? Which uncle?
Charlie Gover. Okay. So he's because you're probably more familiar with. Marshall passed away about a decade ago.
Oh, I knew that. Yeah. Was that another uncle of yours?
Yes, Uncle Marshall. Okay. Yeah, Marshall was an uncle, but no, Uncle Charlie, I think, is the youngest of that generation. So he's.
I think, you know, giving talks is good, you know, and doing videos. We need to get out and do more of that, you know, and they're fun, frankly. I like giving them, you know, I always get nervous, but boy, you end up, you know, after the talk, you realize, hey, I've been talking to these guys now for 2 hours about all kinds of stuff, and you learn a lot. You know, we learn a lot from, particularly if you go out in the public and, you know, guy says, oh, I know where this is or that is. And, you know, anyway, so, yeah.
But it's important in that book that you're working on. I'm super excited for it because, you know, when I was doing my master's and dissertation, there were never any like recently published overviews of Great Plains archaeology. It was like 1998. You had Bob's book from 2006.
Yeah.
The last time someone did a Central Plains volume was like Waddell. The 70s or something? And so it's been cool to see one Doug do that giant monograph, but you working on Nebraska thing. And then I reached out to Bob Horde like with a couple months ago. I was like, are you going to do an updated volume of Kansas archaeology? He's like, no, but I'd love to co-author it with somebody. And I was like, let me do some other things first.
Yeah, the Kansas one that Bob and Will Banks did is really good. It's certainly more academic than what we're producing, but it's great. I mean, I use it a lot. It's, you know, because a lot of it, it's Kansas, but a lot of it applies to Nebraska.
Oh, 100%. Like it's the,
and,
you know.
You know, and same thing with Doug Bamforth's couple-year-old volume now. And I think Sarah Trabert and Casey Hollenbeck did another kind of overview. It's an SAA press book. Also came out about the same year as Doug's did. Those are really great. In fact, we rely on them a lot. But they're not super accessible to the general public. You know, I think you got to have both. You got to have both, you know, so.
Yeah, trying to teach, like, because I teach the Great Plains archaeology courses here at KU, and having those big books kind of helps, other than it's a lot of slides on individual sites. And we talk about Macintosh a lot.
Good.
That's always a good one. But some other projects you got to work on, which you came out with, you know, that rather large manuscript on the engineer cantonment. So you can tell the audience a little bit about that whole, what is that place? And then what were those excavations like?
Yeah, that was a lot of fun. There was a kind of an overshadow by Lewis and Clark. There was an expedition called the Stephen Long Expedition, 1819, 1820. another government expedition, but it was designed to kind of be a scientific expedition of the plains under the command of Major Stephen Long. And they went across the Central Plains out to the Rockies and came across back on the Southern Plains. They got out to north of Omaha in the fall of 1819. It was part of the Yellowstone expedition and wintered over. They built some log cabins. There were about 20 guys. They stayed there for the winter and did a bunch of scientific investigations, studying plants, animals, geology, working with tribes. They were, you know, they had a lot of councils with tribes and, you know, kind of early, we didn't call it ethnography, but it was ethnography. The rivers, you know, that was what they were tasked with. And so there's this place, they called it Engineer Cantonment because these guys were engineers, some of them. And we'd always knew it was somewhere north of Omaha within a several mile range, but we didn't know, never did find it. Found a lot of trading posts, but we never found Engineer Cantonment. But one of the guys was an artist, Titian Peale. His father was Charles Wilson Peale, who painted pictures of the founding fathers and all that stuff. And he was an artist, and he made a painting of their little cabins and the river and the bluffs. And we used that painting, copy of the painting, to find it. We just kept kind of, Gail Carlson and I went up and down for a couple of miles looking for a bluff line in a particular ravine and a particular, you know, setting that looked like this place that this guy pictured, you know, made a painting of 200 years ago, and found it. And it's like, man, that looks like just like the place. And started putting in a couple little cable, you know, trenches that they put fiber optic cables in, and up come musket balls and trade beads, and, you know, there it was. And it was really well preserved. You know, the cabins were long gone, but the foundations and the fireplaces, it was in a farmyard, never been cultivated, on a little alluvial fan. It was a lot of fun. It was a fun project because it was good archaeology, well preserved. It had a whole lot of archival stuff. You know, these guys made all kinds of paintings and notes. And so we were able to draw from history, archaeology, oral traditions. They were hanging out with the Pawnee, the Odo, the Omaha, going on hunting expeditions with them. In fact, there's paintings of councils sitting right there in the front yard of these cabins and, you know, having feasts. And so it was really a multidisciplinary project. It was fun to use a painting to find a site. You know, it wasn't the first time, but it was pretty cool. And it was a fun multidisciplinary project. Great, you know, great material. It was amazing for only 9 months how much material there was. You know, these guys broke a lot of pipes, dropped a lot of musket balls, and dropped a lot of plates and glasses. And the other thing is they were studying, you know, plants and animals. So they were actually preparing skeletons and preparing, you know, hides and stuff. So some of the animals that the animal bone we found maybe from their scientific experiment. So it was, you know, it was different. It was a different kind of site, a scientific, or an early scientific, you know, expedition, the archaeology of a scientific expedition. A lot of fun. Yeah. And it was only 10 minutes. It was only 20 minutes from my house. I got to go home every night, which is great.
that means a lot more, especially to me, the older I get in this field, where projects where I could get home to see my cat as often as possible.
Yeah, it was a fun project.
Awesome. Yeah. Well, Rob, it's been such a pleasure to have you on. Definitely going to have you come on in the future, maybe talk about some individual sites, because I think we're starting to gear towards that. We've done a lot of overviews on the podcast, introduced folks to a lot of people, and maybe talk about sites like McIntosh or Engineer Cantonment would be a blast. So, I mean, like, kind of final thoughts for the audience. What's a reason or two why people should be more interested in becoming Great Plains archaeologists?
Well, the thing that's kind of that I love about Plains archaeology is it's what it's not. You know, we don't have Cahokia, we don't have Chaco Canyon, we don't have Jamestown, you know, we don't have the Alamo. We've got the archaeology of the Plains is more fragile, it's more nuanced, but it still represents many thousands and thousands and thousands of people that lived here, you know, in Nebraska and Kansas and Iowa and Colorado, and, you know, that. You know, we don't know anything about these people. They deserve to have their stories told. And the only way to tell those stories is through archaeology and oral traditions and, you know, whatever. And I think that, you know, there's a lot of great, really wonderful Great Plains archaeology. Plains Village stuff is really sexy. It's, you know, there's a lot of it. But also, you know, people have been here for We don't know how long they've been here. We know it's probably way more than 13,000 years. We know that. We don't know how long. It keeps getting pushed back. But I just, you know, I've always kind of felt that people in the past deserve to have their story told. And, you know, I think it's incumbent upon us to say, okay, hey, we're not Cahokia. Big deal, Cahokia. But we got a lot going on here, too. And let's tell those stories. Plus, it's really pretty out here. I mean, the Great Plains are great. You know, it's a pretty environment. And it's fun to think about how people lived. You know, when you look out on these landscapes, particularly areas that are now put back to pasture and that, you know, you don't see crops, like, wow, you know, 2,000 years ago, there was a bunch of people living there doing this stuff that there's nothing like our lives today. Nothing like it.
Absolutely. I always tell my students, if you want to make a meaningful contribution to archaeology, trying to figure out the Central Plains Archaic would be deeply meaningful.
Yeah. And there's some really interesting stuff in there. Long distance trade, you know, with these people 5,000 years ago from Gulf of Mexico. And there's some really interesting stuff going on. And, you know, we don't know much about it. You know, we'll never be done. That's one thing about archaeology. You're never going to be done. You know, I mean, we may be done personally, but not the profession.
Absolutely. Well, it's been such a pleasure to have you on, Rob. Yeah. All right, everyone. That was episode 29. I'm not quite sure who's going to be on episode 30, but we're going to have another state archaeologist. We're going to figure out which state. By the time this comes out, we'll know. So we'll catch you guys next time for episode 30 of the Great Plains Archaeology Podcast. Thank you for listening to the Great Plains Archaeology Podcast. You can follow me on Instagram at Pawnee_archaeologist, and you can also email me at greatplainsarcpodcast@gmail.com. And remember, anybody can love the mountains, but it takes a soul to love the prairie. American author Willa Cather.
The Archaeology Podcast Network is 10 years old this year. Our executive producer is Ashley Airy. Our social media coordinator is Matilda Siebrecht. And our chief editor is Rachel Roden. The Archaeology Podcast Network was co-founded by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle in 2014 and is part of Cultural Media and DigTech LLC.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.